All right, hey all. It's been a while since I spoke at this conference. It's great to be here presenting again. And for a change of pace, I won't be doing the usual Dynalink talk that I'm doing, that I've been doing in all previous cases that I was presenting here. Rather, this is more of a, like a hands-on case study of what happens when you try to implement a language on the JVM, and specifically some of the things that we sort of like lessons learned while we were trying to fit NASA on the JVM with a specific focus on integration features between your language and the underlying platform. As for the things that are related to the like generating bytecode for the language itself and so on, I won't be talking about that. That will be Marcus' talk on Wednesday. I will be more focused on the actual integration features. You'll see what those are. Typical, I work for Oracle. Okay, this is your typical I work for Oracle slide. What I want to talk to is intricacies in writing adapter classes when invoke dynamic is involved. Some fun with type conversions. Things with handling arrays, this is actually a little bit surprising that you need to take care of that thing, but turns out that there's things with that. Then there is how do we provide the illusion of the existence of packages in your language and whether it's a good idea to do it at all. And of course, I will be talking about Dynalink in the linking section, and also about security, which is an often overlooked issue, but for us it's fairly crucial in NASHON, because of course this thing will ship in Java 8, and of course it will be living in JRE libext, which means that it will run with all privileges. So, I want nothing less in my life than to be the guy in the spotlight as being responsible for the next security vulnerability in Java, so we are trying to be very conscious about that. So you want to write a language on the JVM. Well, okay. And you can have a language that lives in a vacuum and doesn't integrate with your platform in any way, or you want to have some integration features that I just listed. Without much further ado, we'll just jump head first into the things. I tried really hard to cut down this talk, and I still ended up with way too many slides. So, I'm comfortable. This audience can keep up the pace, so it will be fine. In most dynamic languages, if you're doing this thing, so this is how you implement a runnable in NASHORN. You just say new JavaLang runnable, pass it an object literal after actually the parentheses. That's a syntax extension, but you don't need to do that. The object literal has a member run, which is a function that does something. It can be even simpler because we support passing a function to the constructor if the thing is actually a single abstract method type. So without further ado, we can just do a new JavaLang runnable, pass it a function, that's it. All right. Obviously, we create adapter classes, proxies, if you will. Also, obviously, we are not using JavaLang reflect proxy because we're not doing reflection, we are doing invoke dynamic. So how does the how does a adapter class look when it's implemented around invoke dynamic? Well, normally it looks like this on fields level. Obviously, I cannot put the full code of this class on single slide because it would be, you would really need to have really good eyes for that. So we'll go in small bite size chunks. So first thing is the package. We normally try to define the adapter class in the same package where the interface or being implemented or class being adapted lives, except that you cannot define things in the JavaLang and the associated packages. So in that case, we just define it in some internal stuff. We have a field for the defining global context for JavaScript. This is language specific. You might need it, you might not need it, we need it. And then you have a method handle for all the methods that can be implemented. Interestingly, for interfaces, we will allow overriding of two string hash code and equals as well. So aside from a field for a method handler for run, you have two string hash code and equals here. So How does a constructor for this thing look like? You need to get an object literal that carries the functions that are the implementations for your thing. So our constructors, even if they normally the class constructor, right? So the runnable will have as a superclass JavaLang object. JavaLang object has a zero argument constructor. We'll always create constructor that takes n additional parameters. So if you have five constructors, we will define those same five constructors, but with a tagged on object argument that will carry the information. That will carry the implementation. And what we do is that we pass a name of a function and the object to a library method that we have that extracts the handle and then puts it in the field. And I repeat this for the every method handle field, but no big deal. If you were to write this in Java, it would look something like that. So for every field, you would just do this get handle where you pass the object, pass the name of the function that you want to get back, and you pass the signature that you expect back from your method handle. Again, not terribly complicated. This library function that we use, the get handle, what it does is again some JavaScript specific stuff. Normally, this is the meat of it, is that you retrieve the member from your script object. If it's a script function, then you do some things like bind that handle to the receiver, and then adapt handle is just something that massages types. Otherwise, bad things ensue. And we also have this little quirk, is that since every JavaScript object does have a toString by virtue of its prototype, we don't just blindly use it because it will always be found. We only override it if it's like specifically defined on the object itself. So if you pass an object literal that only inherits toString through its prototype, then we won't use that as an override, which otherwise would lead to surprising results. If the interface being implemented is a single abstract method interface, then we will generate yet another constructor. So for every original public or protected constructor, we emit one that takes an object, and we might emit another one that takes a script function this time. And in that case, what we do is we associate that single passed function with the actual SAM method. And all the other methods, toString equals, hashcode, and so on, they're initialized to null. If this code were written in Java, we generate bytecode with ASM, then it would look something like this. So you again go to our service class, tell it, hey, here's a function, adapt it to this method type, store it in the run field, and all the other guys are null. We also have we also store the defining context that we need, and the last line is obviously the null pointer check. So for every public construction, for every public or protected construct in the superclass, we will emit one or two new constructors that have an additional object or maybe an additional script function argument. We had a little bit of a debate whether the include this extra argument at the beginning of the parameter list or at the end of the parameter list for the constructor. Putting it at the end prevailed. I personally sort of objected to it because it meant that var arg constructors can no longer be var arg, but whatever, I was overvoted. So now the adapters will not be, the variable arity of a constructor in a superclass will unfortunately not be preserved. This is something that you might want to consider in your language or not. The fun thing is that at the runtime, when you are doing this thing at the start, when I said that you can do this or you can do this, the actual dispatching, so which constructor gets invoked, we don't have any special code for that. It's completely handled by Dynalink's overloaded method resolution. You know, if you get a script function, it will invoke the constructor that takes a script function. In every other case, it will invoke the one with the object. So how do the methods look like, right? So a run will typically, normally an implementation of a method that's abstract in superclass, you load your field with the method handle. If it's not null, you do your thing. If it's null, well, just throw an unsupported operation exception. That's it. Of course, this is grossly simplified. For a non-abstract method, what you do is that if your method handle is null, you will just do an invoke special, which is basically a super invocation. Again, not terribly big deal. Of course, it gets more complicated because this is invoke dynamic, and every invoke exact can throw trouble. So you actually need to have exception handlers around this thing. Obviously, runtime exception and error can just be rethrown, and if the method originally declares itself any checked exceptions, you can just rethrow those. For everything else, you need to construct something. We construct a new runtime exception and throw that. That's for trouble. I actually just realized when I was writing this is in bytecode, oftentimes you can do like a little optimizations that otherwise don't come out in Java C. As in, so this is the catch block for trouble, where you need to construct a new runtime exception. And it turned out that the shortest way to do this is this. I mean, how often do you get to use dupe x1, right?
All the time.
All the time? Yes, maybe. Yeah, they really liked it. Again, in Java, this would normally would look like this. So if your field is your method handler field is not, just go to super. Otherwise, just do an invoke exact on your actual thing. Of course, it's more complicated because we have this whole context object thing, which you might exist in your language or not. So we need to have code that checks whether this context is the same that you had when it was created. If not, temporarily switch to the new one, and then in the final block restore the previous one. Again, this is like tedious details that you don't really want to pay a lot of attention to, but unfortunately sometimes you just have to. All right, quick question. Am I going too fast? Yes?
We use it about 20 times in Python's
what?
Dupe X1.
Oh, Dupe X1.
Yeah.
Okay.
In terms of individual methods in the code,
yes. Yeah. No, I mean, for me, it was just one of those, I was thinking, how can I write this most efficiently? I was like, hey, dupe X1, why not?
Yes. Your yellow font is hard to read.
Oh, I'm sorry about that. I don't think I really use it a lot more than here, so fine, but thanks. Yeah. All right. We have another thing, which is... So these are so-called instance-bound adapters. So when you are invoking the constructor, you are passing an object with the behavior. But you might also want to have a situation when you have class-based behavior. So you want an adapter where on the class level, the behavior is already defined. So if you create several instances of it, they will all have the same behavior. We do actually have this in NASHorn. I think originally it came about as a need for JavaFX, because in JavaFX you don't instantiate your FX application, rather the JavaFX framework accepts that you just pass them a class and it will internally somehow instantiate it itself. So we needed this as well. So when you have this constructor with a class behavior, you suddenly acquire a whole new set of fields. You can have an instance global, you can have a static global. You have the method handles for instance behavior, because even with the class-based behavior, you can still, at the construction time, specify additional overrides for instance-based behavior. So it becomes like a two-step overrides at that point. So we have static fields for method handles for static behavior and instance fields for instance behavior. It's, yes?
So your run method currently picks up the self-bound method handle and then runs it.
Yes.
But your run method could also have picked it up and then run it with a prepended argument.
Well, we do bind it because it's still in JavaScript, that object literal, the implementation, could say this something, right? So that's why we bind it. Oh no, it's not the self object. It's the global object of the runtime context. That's not the self.
Oh, there's no self object here.
No, there's no self object here. They're all bound into the method handle. The global is actually the global context, the thing that contains things like the function prototype and so on that it needs. So that's not the equivalent of this. It's actually the current runtime environment's global object.
It still seems to me that you don't need to double all the elements
locked,
but that's just
the way. Well, all can be overridden on an instance basis. So in this case, we do. But these are two different classes, so we emit two different adapter classes. If you're doing instance-based behavior, you get one, and in this case, you get the other one. So, and of course, in this case, we need to initialize the class-based object class-based behavior is initialized in the static initializer. And here's actually a conundrum. How do you pass an argument to a static initializer, right? So the only thing that we could come up is, well, pass it in a thread local. So our method that does the Java extend where you pass the type and pass the object, if you go back here, what this guy does is it creates this adapter and sets a thread local with this object and then loads the class, and then as part of the class loading, it will retrieve the object from the thread local. But you know, that's what you have to do. It's not really any better way to pass it. But since you know that everything happens on that one thread, I think it's a perfectly valid way to pass information to a static initializer.
Does the spec actually guarantee that?
Sorry? Yes, it does, because when we load the class, we specifically set the resolve flag to true, which means we want the class to be resolved, and the resolution means running static initializers.
But I don't remember if the spec says that it has to be run on that thread.
You are right. Oh, wait.
If they're not running that thread, there's going to be a happens before edge that means anything that was written in that was visible. Right?
Yeah, but...
If another thread is in the middle of already doing the initialization, mm-hmm. then it will wait for that other thread to finish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it was still. But then it will still not see the thread local. So, it's interesting. Thanks. Thanks for bringing this up. Because I want to look into that, whether the initialization is guaranteed to go on the same thread. But
I think it is assumed to be, because there's a whole bunch of logic in class initialization about what happens if other threads try to initialize the same class. It rather implies that.
Yeah, I hope it's right. I mean, it did work so far, so then obviously the individual implementations of these classes of the methods will basically say, hey, do I have an instance-based override? I do invoke exact that. No, I don't. Do I have a static override? Invoke that. Otherwise, default to super.
Yep.
The class, it cannot be loaded. What do you mean already loaded?
I mean, you have another snippet of code that uses runner.
Oh.
And then if you
are doing the Java extend, yep, with a class name and a class-based behavior object literal, which actually can be any object expression, doesn't have to be literal, but usually is, a new class is loaded every time. So a new private class loader is being defined and a new class is loaded into it. We generate bytecode only once, but then we just keep it around as a byte array. But we are instantiating a new class every time because we need a fresh set of static fields, obviously. Yes?
For what it's worth, this is how we are doing both of these cases in JRuby for the past 6 years.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Thread local and all. So.
Yeah, okay, excellent.
It works.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. Yes? Well, because, I mean, this is the like Java equivalent code. You need to have a lot of try catches because invoke exact can throw trouble.
Yeah, but you know, usually you know if you call your runtime or some Java things.
Mm-hmm.
If it's some Java things, it can throw exception.
Yep.
And you have to use a try catch. Otherwise, your exceptions are already wrapped, so you don't need to catch it to re-throw it.
My exception is wrapped. Sorry, I'm not. I don't think I follow.
It's already an exception which is generated from your runtime.
Right.
So it's already in the correct.
Oh yeah, you're right about that. So what I'm showing you here, but if it were a method that in the superclass actually declares that it throws some checked exception, then that thing will just be allowed to propagate.
Okay, said differently, why you use invoke exact here and not invoke dynamic? Because if it's invoke dynamic, you know, and you can do the try catch.
You mean that I could emit bytecode with invoke dynamic that I would then afterwards.
You have a method under that does that. You have a method under that do try catch.
He's suggesting that you could compress your code idioms down into custom expanded invoke dynamic. Use invoke dynamic as a bytecode macro.
Yeah. Yes, we could use that. Yeah, I mean, yeah, you're right. I could probably just do a catch exception combinator there at that point, and
yeah, but you can do that at call site and not at
not statically.
Yes.
So that at call site you know what is the exception.
Exactly.
Well, I guess we could. It's just the idea was that we have a method handler, we have to somehow invoke it, and I don't mind generating a small amount of bytecode, because it does amount in the end to a small amount of bytecode, especially try catch blocks, right? So it's not really a big deal. I still feel like I prefer if I can help it to have a little bit of like static. I mean, if I'm generating code already, I might as well just generate that bytecode instead of resorting to invoke dynamic. But you're right, it's not. This is not the only valid solution. You have something to add to the chat?
Then you have to also wonder how many additional levels of Lambda forms you're adding to do the rest of that code rather than just...
Well, there might be that as well, yes. So yeah, I'm fairly happy with this.
Form is not a magic thing to say. I would not use invoke dynamic.
I know.
Yeah, but here I'm fairly happy with how this works, so.
I have a different question. Which
yes? Yes, it does.
The corresponding call to invoke exact in your previous simpler example also take O as a parameter?
It should. I mean, these are like handwritten codes, so if I manage to... I'm not sure which one. This one? Mm-hmm. Yep. Sometimes I'm showing exactly with the run, and sometimes I'm showing it with a two string, and sometimes equals. I'm not using the same example all the time. So maybe at some points I'm using two string, for example. So
I'm trying to visualize how the wires connect. And so there are several forms of this floating around.
Well, yes, you have the adapters this, and then you have the JavaScript this, and they are distinct, obviously. So. Yep. All right. Where were we? Okay. All right. So. Okay. So, a fun thing is figuring out overrides and overloads. So, how do you override overloaded methods? Because in JavaScript, it doesn't have the concept of type signatures, right? So what we adopted as a policy, and again, design decision that has its trade-offs, is if you have a named function, it will act as an override for all overloads of the same name. If some of those are abstract and others are not abstract, we don't care. All of them will be overridden and implemented by that single function. And it's your job to just, on JavaScript side, if you need to distinguish the behavior for different overloads, you will just have to inspect the argument list on your own and do your own dispatch. There's really nothing you can do. This is a JavaScript-specific issue. It is what it is. Security. As I said, security is a big thing for us. Only we are very strict about only extending implementing public classes interfaces. Those that are in restricted packages are subject to access check. This only works if you have a security manager present, otherwise it's free for all, obviously. You can only override public and protected methods, and so far we are preventing implementing of caller sensitive methods because they would mess up with the right caller identification. It might be something that we might do about that sometime in the future, but I don't think there's currently a good solution for this. Like having some transparent, I'm operating on behalf of this code, so I'm like transparent as far as caller identification goes, but let's not go there right now. There's actually not too many caller sensitives that you can override in JDK. The only example that I have is thread get context class loader. Yes, that's the only one that can be overridden.
And it's generally a mistake to do
so. Yes, so we absolutely prevent it. The adapters themselves are loaded into a protection domain which runs with all privileges. They are just really a simple delegating pass-through invokers, really, so they themselves don't do anything. So we must make sure that they don't narrow the privileges in both the callee and the caller. They themselves don't use do privileged blocks, so they cannot act as an escalator. But they're not narrowing the effective set of privileges either. So this is basically how we load them. We have a protection domain that we generate one that just has all permissions in it, and then a class loader will be loading them. Obviously, you need to have a create class loader runtime permission for your code, but with NASHON it's not an issue because again it runs in the it lives in a jar file in extension directory. There's also an interesting question of where do you define your adapter? This turned out that you need to do a little bit of a calculation here. The Java extend method allows specifying multiple, up to one class and an arbitrary number of interfaces that your adapter will implement at once. And those can actually come from different class loaders. So you actually need to find one class loader that can see the classes defined in all the other class loaders, plus the NASHON's runtime classes. And now if you manage to, well, it's basically a, maximum calculation on a partial ordering relation of IC classes from other class loader on the class loaders, and if you can find a maximum, then you're happy and you can define the adapter. Otherwise, you can actually run into a situation where you cannot define the adapter. So an adapter that defines that implements two interfaces from wildly different class loaders, well, you won't be able to do it. So type conversion. Marcus will have more about that. Type conversion.
String 10.
Oh, string 10, sorry. the scar tissue. Okay.
Why not just create a class loader of multiple parents?
I don't know. I don't like that. Well, first thing is that class loaders do have a single parent as defined by in the class loader class itself, right? The class loader class itself has a parent field, and it has one. So multi-parented class loaders are something that, I heard that like EE containers are sometime playing games with that, but I don't feel comfortable with that. I am willing to risk it so far that if people are doing that, they will get an exception in their face. Yeah, and there might be other issues as well. I just didn't want to get entangled into that. So what we do with type conversions, I mean, almost everything is fairly trivial except for like crazy JavaScript things like the string false, actually, if you need to convert it to a Boolean, it evaluates to true because it's only the empty string that actually evaluates to false in JavaScript. So if you do things like, disregard the syntax at the top. It actually allocates a Java array of primitive Boolean type with a size of 1. And then if you just do these things where you just print what does it do, then you will see that an empty array will be true and an empty object will be true because every object evaluates to true. And the only thing that's weird is that the string false evaluates to true. The picture is a little bit different if you allocate an array of capital B Booleans, because then you have these two things that null and undefined, we decided to evaluate them to null. So if your destination type actually can represent the null value, then if you have something that reasonably translates to null value, you will actually get that instead. So in converting to box types, we do actually preserve nulls. Stuff that's nifty in our type type conversions is that if you're invoking a Java method and it accepts a SAM type, then you can just pass a function and we will figure out, our type conversion will figure out, here's a function, I need a SAM type, it will on the fly create you an adapter and that uses the function as the implementation. So for a collection sort, you need a comparator. You know, it's like sort of an instant lambdification of that for JavaScript. One thing that came up as I was implementing these things was need to prioritize comparisons. Turns out that the overloaded method resolution can trip on things. Like you create a new thread and you pass it a function. So what should it be? Should it actually be a, should this be treated the function as a runnable that's passed to the thread constructor accepting a runnable? But the problem is JavaScript also allows an implied object to string conversion, in which case you might actually be creating a thread that's named after whatever is the string representation of the object that you passed. So the problem is, by definition, whenever your language allows more conversions than the Java language specification allows, you will be widening your set of applicable methods at every overload resolution opportunity. And so you will get ambiguities. That's why you need to have a mechanism to the, where you can yourself specify what conversions are allowed. And we actually have this. This is also, you can implement an interface and a comparison comparator that is given a source type and two possible target types and say which one of those is more appropriate. So at least for the Nashorn linker, we figured out that whenever one of the types is an interface, we will decide to pick up that one because you are probably actually going for the implementation of an interface and not the string representation of the object. Strings, numbers, booleans, pretty much the same thing. The problem is they are considered JavaScript primitives, so JavaScript primitive values, string, boolean, and number are implemented using the box numbers and booleans and strings. They pretty much behave as such, except that we also allow invocation of Java methods on them. So you can do things like foo.hashcode, and a hashcode is obviously only exists on Java-lang string. It doesn't exist on the JavaScript version. Primitive conversion prioritization. I'll skip this because I will be running out of time. And I showed you this already. Okay, arrays. We ran into a situation when arrays can be nasty, right? JavaScript arrays have heterogeneous types, can grow and shrink, and can be sparse. So they are pretty much different from Java arrays in any possible way.
Don't forget changing the prototype.
Oh yeah, changing the prototype of the native JavaScript array, but you will have a slide about that. I won't talk about this. So while we are doing a lot of implicit conversions when you are passing to Java methods, we decided that the correct way to do when passing a JavaScript array in place of a Java array is to refuse it. We are not doing an implicit conversion there. I mean, there's no way I will allow a potentially unbounded memory conversion to just take place implicitly, okay? So if you do this, like you use JavaLang array, it's JavaLang reflect array, to string, if you just pass it a JavaScript literal, nope, it won't work. You will get class cast exception or equivalent. What you need to do is that this is the only place in Java, in Nashorn where you need to use explicit conversions, and we introduced a method on our capital J Java object, which is our only entry point to the Java API, that's simply just named to. And this will work. I mean, API design is always a trade-off. You can't really do anything about that. And by making it explicit, we also want to have the programmer feel, have the explicit feeling that, I mean, this is like programming ergonomics, really, that they are creating something that instance is divorced from the other one, because you cannot do two-way updating, right? Because what happens if the JavaScript array gets resized? How do you represent in the original value the newly created or truncated element? So this at least cognitively will tell them that you are creating a copy and there's no two-way updates between them. So the Java 2 actually takes another argument. There's a class, and the default value for class is object array, but you can use it for other things. And there is a Java from, which is like a symmetrical API. You normally don't have to use it because syntax-wise, Nashorn will happily be using arrays in Java arrays in for in and the square bracket syntax. It's only when you want to leverage the things that you have in the JavaScript array prototype, like map, reduce, filter, whatever, is that when you really need to convert and then run with that. Component type conversion, again, you know, they have like a heterogeneous array of a number, a boolean, a string, and you want to convert to an int class. This will use language conversion logic to convert to int element wise. And our code for this looks a little bit like this. What it does, we have these Dynalink linker services. We can ask for a type converter from your class to the component type, and it just goes in a loop and just do an array set and doesn't invoke exact on whatever is our type converter. And obviously, I could have rewritten this to not use array set, but rather use an array setter element handle and fold the other one into it. I actually, this idea came to my mind as I was writing this slide, so maybe I will change it. Our arrays, our native arrays, they don't implement the list interface. Reason for that is that their parent, which is the script object, right? In JavaScript, array is descended from object, and object do implement map. And arrays don't implement list. Why is that? Well, it's because there's no such force that will make a class in Java implement both the list and the map, and that's because the signatures for the remove are incompatible between the two.
Yeah, but you are in bytecode.
Can't win.
The bytecode can distinguish between
It can?
You just can't write Java source code like that.
I think I had some issues with this, I will try it because, well, oh wait, but this is not bytecode. This is Java code. We have like a Java code of Nashorn is like public class, native array, extends script object, implements list, bam.
This is a word bridge method will be dead.
Yes. Okay, but yeah. Oh, hash code contracts also can be satisfied. All right, another good point. So anyway, that's why we also need to have the Java 2. So you have a native array when you're passing it in a place of a list is expected. Unfortunately, you need to do conversion because we cannot make native array actually be a list because there is a parent of it that implements map. Well, you can say it's silly, but it's what it is. Statics. So there's always a debate when you're doing a dynamic language whether the runtime class object, whether you use it as a gateway to statics and constructors and so on. Well, we do not. Because as a Java programmer, you instinctively know what's the difference between Java IO file in your Java source and Java IO file dot class, right? There's two things. One is the runtime representation of a class, and the other is just an identifier that you use as a prefix for addressing into the static namespace and for invoking constructors. They're separate concepts, and they don't really mix well in a language. So what we have is Dynalink actually has a static class, which is just like a little wrapper around the class. It doesn't do anything, it just contains a class. But when a linker sees one of these guys, and when you try to invoke methods on it, it will actually link you to the static methods on the class that encapsulates. It will also link to our constructors. So it also has synthetic methods, like if you link it to the getProperty class, it will actually like retrieve the class that's below it. That's also one thing that we do. Package thing, actually, I will run out of time. It's just that we have so many things that came up, and I would like to talk about all of them, but I have to cull things. We have this thing where packages are not really reified in Java, right? So there is no such thing as figuring out whether a package exists. But your languages still want to like do things like new Java util list and JavaScript, what does it do? You have like a global object named Java and you try to address util on it, then you will see, do I have a class with this name? No, well, it must be a package. And then you have problems with I call this the stepping stones approach, and I really hate it. Because there are typos, right? So if you say Java util array list, if you have a bit of a pirate persuasion, then the thing will just say, well, maybe there's a package with that name. And then when you try to instantiate it, you will have late detection. Yes, Remy?
Yeah. Come on. For that, I have a toy implementation of Ruby
okay.
that sends
yeah.
the whole
right.
Java util
okay.
something as a string and
uh-huh.
resolve it in Invoke Dynamic.
Okay. Well, what we do is, why did I put this in? So anyway, in yeah, let's skip through this. In Asom, we actually support this, but we also introduced this Java type where you just pass a fully qualified name of a class, and it either resolves or it does not. And you can typically retrieve a class, and then you can invoke instances on it. You can actually invoke like constructors immediately, except that you need to have a little bit of fun with parentheses. Otherwise, it doesn't know whether the parentheses is actually for the Java type or it goes to the constructor. But the good thing is that it also supports arrays, so you don't have to do like the Java Lang Reflect array, whatever, to create arrays. I mean, the idea is I want to educate the users. Use this, don't use that. Maybe that looks idiomatically like Java, but you know, guess what? Dorothy, you're not in Kansas anymore. This is not Java, so we might do something to make you look like Java, but not necessarily. Yes. I would love to convince Jim.
Okay.
All right. And of course, I will talk a little bit about Dynalink. Nason embeds Dynalink. It underwent quite a lot of improvements as a result of having an actual client runtime. If you want to adopt it, you still can. It is available as a standalone project. Licensing is the same, so you know, feel free to. But it now we have a copy that's you know, package renamed in JDK as well. One thing that came out was like Dynalink used to have methods for like knew about verbs for linking to a property getter, to an element getter, to a method getter, that's actually a new one. And JavaScript happens to not have separate namespaces for these. So which one do you use when you want to link? And the solution I came up with was, well, you know, all of them. I figured out that we can have composite operations. When you are linking, you actually specify this thing as an operation. So an object.foo will say, I want a property preferably, but if you don't have it, an element or a method will also do. And if you happen to immediately invoke the thing, then I will actually prefer a method. And if you use the square brackets, then the elements get precedence. And if you invoke the something that you get through the square bracket operator, then it's a method, then it's an element, that's a property. Again, the fun thing is that when you are just linking to native JavaScript objects, they don't really care because for them, all of these link to the same namespace, but when you link to beans, then it actually can be interesting. So of course, I rewrote the beans linker to correctly support all of them. In most cases, you can just resolve it at link time, so you know in which namespace you will find it on a bean. The only exception is if you like start with a get element and what you are linking to is a map. In that case, you actually need to have like a guard with test that cascades, try to get an element and then falls through to the other one. But otherwise, it's really no performance impact of this. Linking security, we're using public lookup for cacheable methods, and cacheable is almost everything except caller sensitive these days. But we also correctly handle caller sensitives. I remember there was this email thread on the MLVM about the introduction of the caller sensitive and the issues that the Groovy folks have with them. At least if you use Dynalink, you don't have these issues, fortunately, because I correctly handle those things. We have a bunch of other improvements, but I actually won't be talking about them because I don't have time. Check out the change notes on the Dynalink website. I'm pretty much writing about all of these there. We are leveraging it from Java in a lot of places. Like here's actually a good example is the implementation of native array to string. Invokes the join method on the JavaScript object that it operates on, which doesn't necessarily have to be a native array. So, and we implemented native array to string in Java, but we need to invoke the JavaScript join method on it. So what we do is I have this little class that's called invoke by name, where you pass it a name and a signature, say the, and it will actually retrieve you. Go to your bootstrap method, retrieve, tell it, give him a call site for this method, and then retrieve its dynamic invoker, and then store it in the fields. And then afterwards, when you want to use this thing, then all you do is your two string for native array will say, okay, invoke the getter that retrieves me the join function on this object, and if it's actually something that's callable, then invoke the invoker for the function. There's a few levels of indirections, but this is modulo error handling, right? And I will actually be able to finish this on time. Apparently, I have a few words still on security. So, security story so far. You have noticed that I've mentioned some security features from time to time. So, to recap, we prevent access to non-public members in Dynalink and also to classes and restricted packages. Now, that's stricter than Java, but that's a conscious decision so far, right? We want to be more on the safe side. So, there is a set of things that Java code can do, and we like cushion this a little bit for NASHORN. So Java code with appropriate privileges will be able to manipulate classes and restricted packages. NASHORN code won't be able to. I stand by this decision so far. I want to get it right eventually so that, it almost sounds like, we don't believe we can get it right. We believe we can get it right, except we need a little bit more time to be sure that we got it right. So for Java 8 timeframe, we won't go to that direction. So, and again, these package restrictions are only in place if you run with Security Manager. Otherwise, you can go to Sun, MISC, Unsafe, and do whatever you want if you are not running with a Security Manager. Dynalink also correctly handles caller sensitive. NASHORN will build additional security features on top of that. Like Java type is unable to access classes and restricted packages. And we have an additional permission named NASHORN Java Reflect that you need to grant to your scripts in order to be able to access class loader, anything in JavaLang invoke, and anything in JavaLang reflect packages. So again, we don't want to be on receiving end of being to blame for the next security exploitation. So these are typically the vectors that are somehow involved in these things. So we just wholesale prevent access to these classes. Again, this is guarded by a runtime permission, which is only in effect if you run with a security manager. So if you are running in a system without a security manager, you are not affected. You can do class forename from your script. If you're running under security manager, you will need to give your classes in Java policy. You will need to specify the URLs for your JavaScript files and tell them they have the NASHORN Java Reflect permission, and then they can do that. Otherwise, they cannot. Yeah, I think I just said all of that. All right, I think this is all I had. This was pretty much a crash course in stuff that we came across while integrating NASHORN with the underlying Java platform. Sorry if I was being a little bit fast, but I didn't want to omit anything, and just cramming it into 45 minutes is not terribly easy. But if you were able to keep up, then thank you. If not, then just catch me anytime in the hallway, and I'm really happy to elaborate on anything in greater detail. So that's it. Thanks.